Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Hi, guys. They've really added a lot of chairs to this room, haven't they? I'm just going to jump right in and read to you for a little while, and then we can do a Q&A, okay? And I'm happy to answer any question that might be on your mind. This comes pretty early on in the book, and I don't think you really need to know much. The main character, the narrator, is a dentist. You'll probably gather that over time. I think that's about it. So I'm going to start. This is from To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. When I looked up from my patient's mouth that morning, Mrs. Convoy was standing there. Most of the time, Mrs. Convoy looked like an unhappy docent. You got the impression that you were about to go on a boring tour of something edifying and that she would make it as punitive as possible. Part of that impression came from her flesh-colored turtlenecks, which was tucked severely into her slacks and fit tightly over her splayed ARP breasts. And part of it came from her silvered crew cut, and part of it came from her pale facial down, which stood straight up on her neck and cheeks as if trying to attract balloons. But on this occasion, she was beaming at me. "What?" I said. "You did it, you." "Did what?" "I thought you were dead set against, but you did it." "Tell me what you're talking about, Betsy." "The website." "What website?" "Our website," she said. I swiveled away from my patient and snapped off my latex gloves. "We don't have a website," I said. But it turns out that I was in for a surprise. Betsy Convoy was my head hygienist and a devout Roman Catholic. If ever I was tempted to become a Christian, which I never was, but if I was, I thought I would do well to become a Roman Catholic like Mrs. Convoy. She attended Mass at St. Joan of Arc Church in Jackson Heights, where she expressed her faith with hand gestures, genuflections, recitations, liturgies, donations, confessions, lit candles, saints' days, and several different call and responses. Catholics speak like baseball players in the coded language of gesture. Sure, the Roman Catholic Church is an abomination to man and a disgrace to God, but it comes with a highly structured Mass, several sacred pilgrimages, the oldest songs, the most impressive architecture, and a whole bunch of things to do whenever you enter the church. Taken all together, they make you one with your brother. Say I would come in from outside and go straight to the sink to wash my hands. It never mattered which sink, Mrs. Convoy would find me. She'd sniff at me like a bloodhound, and then she'd say, "What exactly have you been doing?" I'd tell her, and she'd say, "Why do you feel the need to lie to me?" I'd tell her, and she'd say, "Scrutiny does not kill people. Smoking kills people. What kind of example do you think you're setting for your patients by sneaking off to smoke cigarettes?" I'd tell her, she'd say, "They do not need a reminder of the futility of it all from their dental professional. When did you take up smoking again?" I'd tell her, she'd say, "Oh, for heaven's sake, then why did you tell everyone you'd quit?" I'd tell her, and she'd say, "I do not see how the occasional show of concern is utterly strangulating. I would like to see you live up to your potential, that is all. Don't you wish you had more self-control?" I'd tell her. She'd say, "Of course I will not join you. What are you doing? Do not light that cigarette." I'd put the cigarettes away with an offhand remark. She'd say, "How am I a trial? I am not the trial here. The trial is between you and your addictions. Do you want to ruin your lungs and die a young man?" I'd tell her. She'd say, "You are not already in hell. Shall I tell you what hell will be like?" I'd answer. She'd say, "Yes, as a matter of fact, any conversation can turn into a discussion on the salvation of the soul. It's a pity more don't. What are you doing at that window?" I'd tell her. She'd say, "We are on the ground floor. You would hardly manage to sprain an ankle." I'd come out of the bathroom, and she'd be standing right there. "I've been looking all over for you," she'd say. "Where have you been?" I'd tell her the obvious. She'd say, "Why must you call it the Thunderbox?" I'd tell her, adding a few details, and she'd grow very severe. She'd say, "Please do not refer to what you do in the bathroom as making the Pope's fountain. I know the Pope is just a joke to you. I know the Catholic Church is nothing but a whetting stone for your wit, but I happen to hold the Church in the highest regard, and though you can't understand that, if you had any respect for me, you would mind what you say about the Pope." I'd answer with an apology, but she'd ignore me. "Sometimes I honestly wonder whether you care about anyone's feelings but your own." And she'd walk away. I'd never learn why she was standing outside the Thunderbox unless it was to bring grief to us both. Later, after letting it fester, she'd say, "Well, tell me, do you care about anyone else's feelings? Do you have any respect for me at all?" Of course I had respect for her. Let's say the day's scheduling worked out as planned and we had 5 cleanings to perform all at once. To minimize wait times and to maximize my turnaround, I would normally require 3, if not 4, dedicated hygienists. But I had Betsy Convoy. Betsy Convoy, with the help of 1 or 2 rotating temps, could manage all 5 chairs. She could x-ray, chart, scale and polish, tutor each patient in preventative treatment, leave detailed notes for my follow-up exams, and still manage to supervise the staff and oversee the scheduling. Most dentists won't believe that, but then most dentists have never had a truly great hygienist like Mrs. Convoy. "Well," she'd say, "why aren't you answering me?" But most days I would have cheerfully stood by and watched her die. Better her dead, I thought, than being around. I would never have found anyone to replace her. But Betsy Convoy being around, there was the true Calvary. Poor Betsy. She was responsible for our efficiency, our professionalism, and a good portion of our monthly billing. Her internalization of Catholicism and its institutional disappointments suited a dental office perfectly, where guilt was often our last resort for motivating the masses. Handing out a toothbrush to a charity patient, she'd tell that person, "Be faithful in small things." Who does that? But then out of nowhere, I'd imagine her getting fucked doggy style by a muscular African on one of the dental chairs. "Of course I respect you, Betsy. We couldn't go on without you." Later at the bar, I'd be the last one to leave. She'd be second to last. She'd say, "Don't you think you've had enough?" I'd tell her. She'd say, "How are you going to get home?" I'd tell her. She'd say, "Connie's gone, dear. She left 2 hours ago. Come on, let's get you home." She'd put me in a cab. She'd say, "Can you handle it from here?" I'd tell her. She'd say, to the cabbie, she'd say, "He lives in Brooklyn," and then I don't know what. We would take a one-off trip somewhere far-flung. I'd fight and fight and say, "No fucking way," but somehow she'd get me on that plane. We once flew from JFK to New Delhi, and from New Delhi to Biju Patniak, and from there took a train 50 kilometers inland, where we walked through the cesspool streets in sweltering heat as limbless beggars crushed behind us, issuing soft exhortations. The clinic was little more than 2 armchairs under a luncheon umbrella. We were stationed right next to the cleft palate folk. It was enough to see them at work. I'd say to her, "I can't believe I let you drag me to this goddamn country." She'd tell me not to take the Lord's name in vain. I'd say, "Might not be the best time to demand a show of respect for the Lord. How much respect did the good Lord show these kids? Pulp necrosis, tongue lesions, goiter-like presentations on account of the abscesses." I could go on. I will go on. Stained teeth, fractured teeth, necrotic teeth, teeth growing one behind the other, open sores, ulcers, gingival discharge, dry sockets, trench mouth, incurable caries, and the malnutrition that follows from the impossibility of eating. Those tender infant mouths never stood a chance. A sane person doesn't stick around in the hopes of making a dent. A sane person takes the next plane home. I stayed for tax reasons. That's it. A solid write-off. And I liked the roasted lamb. You can't find lamb that good, even in Manhattan. Mrs. Convoy said that we were there to do God's work. I'm here for the lamb, I told her. As for God's work, I said, seems like we're undoing it. She disagreed. This was the reason we had been put on earth. Pessimism, skepticism, complaint, and outrage, I said to her, that's why we were put on earth. Unless you were born out here, then it's pretty clear your only purpose was to suffer. A finished biography appealed to Mrs. Convoy more than a work in progress. All of the important men in her life were dead. Christ the Savior, Pope John Paul II, and Dr. Bertram Convoy, also a dentist before his fatal stroke. Betsy was only 60, but had been widowed 19 years. I always considered her alone, if not chronically lonely. But she was never alone. She was in the tripartite company of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, as well as the irreproachable presence of the Virgin Mary, in fellowship with saints and martyrs, one in spirit with the Pope in Rome, deferential to her bishop, confessional to her priest, and friend and comfort to all fellow members of her parish. If the Catholic Church had come under assault for its many sins, inside the Church the bonds had never been stronger. Where was I? And Betsy Convoy needed no one's sympathy for widowhood, solitude, or the appearances of a barren life. I was convinced that she would never die. But if she did die, and though her funeral amount to a very modest affair, she was bound for happy reunions in a better world, in the brotherhood of a loving multitude, while her tombstone was still fresh with wreaths of everlastings. She'd order a book. It was called Stop the Scheduling Madness, or The Way of the Zero Balance Office, or The Million-Dollar Dentist. This last book was written by someone named Barry Hallow. He wasn't even a dentist. He was a consultant. Here's a guy fresh out of business school. He's desperate for a niche. He hears about the chronic problems that plague a dental practice, and he turns himself into an expert. He sits in Phoenix, Arizona, and writes a book. His proven methods can change your practice, your financial health, and even your life expectancy. Most of all, he writes, he can help you achieve happiness. Hey, who doesn't want that? Anything less than complete happiness is for complete losers, really depressed people, old people losing their eyesight, and child actors who turn out to be weird-looking. It wasn't going to happen here, not with Barry Hallow. We schedule inefficiently, treat insufficiently, and bill ineffectively, Mrs. Convoy concluded after reading Barry Hallow. I took exception to the claim that we treated insufficiently. We do not spend enough time, she countered, instructing patients on preventative measures, which in the long run would make them healthier. Preventative measures don't pay the bills, I said. We're running a practice here, not a master class. I know we're not running, and besides, I said, we do in fact spend a hell of a lot of time on preventative measures relative to other practices. But remember who you're talking about, Betsy, human beings. Lazy, short-sighted knockbacks who you try rousing to brush after four glasses of Merlot on a Wednesday night. Ain't gonna happen, no matter how much we preach preventative measures every time they deign to remember an appointment and drag themselves in here like children sent to pick up their toys. Just ain't gonna happen. You have a low opinion of humanity, she'd say. And ignoring her, I'd say, and it's not like we're asking much. The hands take care of themselves, the feet more or less take care of themselves. The nostrils require a little attention from time to time, as does the sphincter. That's about it. A little oral upkeep ain't a lot to ask in exchange for the good times. The bonobos spend their days picking themselves free of ticks and lice. They could be the bonobos. Oh, for heaven's sakes, you've gone off the rails again. Just listen to me for 1 minute, will you? Barry Hallow's methods are proven, and if you just follow the 12 steps he lays out, then he guarantees, I have it written down here somewhere, yes, take the time, the teeth will shine, and the patient will sign on the dotted line. Swell little posy, I said. That clown's not even a dentist. I would like permission to put some of his methods into practice, she said. Will it require any work from any of us? It's likely to require a little more work from some of us, yes. Are any of them me? It's likely, she said. No chance, I said. I kept a deliberately low profile online. No website, no Facebook page. But I'd Google myself, and what came up every time were the same three reviews: the one I wrote, the one I nagged Connie into writing, and the one Anonymous wrote. Don't think I didn't know who Anonymous was. I'd given the guy every opportunity to pay me. He was into me for $8,000. I did the work. I made it possible. Listen, I made it possible for this jerk to resume eating. I was owed cost at the very least. So what does he do? He gets on a payment schedule of $20 a month and then promptly broadcasts his resentment that someone demanded he act honorably by posting a review calling my work shoddy and overpriced. And on top of that, he says, I have cave dwellers. I don't have cave dwellers. I make it a point to inspect my nostrils in the mirror before I go and hover over a patient. It's common courtesy. But now the world thinks that I have cave dwellers. If somebody's doing a little research on the internet for a new dentist, are they likely to choose the guy who might gouge them for lousy work while showering them with his cave dwellers? No. But there is no countering, no appeal, no entity to whom I can plead my case to have the post removed. So I'd Google myself every month or so, and when the review from Anonymous came up, as it did without fail every time, I'd curse out loud and feel the victim of an injustice, and Mrs. Convoy would say, "Stop Googling yourself." She'd say, what do you have against other people? And I'd say, I'd be sitting at the front desk in one of the swivel chairs at the front desk doing paperwork or something, and I'd look up from the paperwork and I'd say, what do I have against other people? I have nothing against other people. And she'd say, you alienate yourself from society. And I'd say, I'd turn physically in the chair to look at her and I'd say, who alienates himself from society? You don't have a website, she'd say, and you refuse to create a Facebook page. You have no online presence. Barry Hallow says, and for this I'm being accused of alienating myself from society because I don't have a Facebook page? All I'm trying to say is that Barry Hallow encourages everyone to have an online presence. An online presence guarantees more business. It's proven. That's all I'm trying to say. No, that's not all you're trying to say, Betsy, I'd say. That's not at all you're trying to say. If it was, you wouldn't have accused me of alienating myself from society. You have misunderstood my intentions, she'd say. I think you have willfully misunderstood me. I don't have anything against other people, Betsy. Do I understand other people? No. Most people I don't understand. What they do mystifies me. They're out there right now, playing in the fields, boating, whatever. Good for them. You know what, Betsy? I'd love to boat with them. Yeah, let's boat. Let's eat shrimp together. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, she'd say, how did we start talking about eating shrimp? I'll never forgive myself for bringing this up. No, don't walk away, Betsy. Let's hash this out. Do you think I can just willy-nilly, without a care in the world, go out there and go boating? Who said anything about going boating, she'd ask. Think I can just toss everything aside and go tanning and rock climbing and pick apples and shop for rugs and order salad and put my change in the same place night after night and wash the sheets and listen to you two and drink Chablis? What on earth are you talking about, she'd say. I was only trying to convince you to build a website and get on Facebook to improve our billings. I have no idea why I can't do those things, I'd say, but I can't. I want to do them, those ordinary night and weekend things, holiday things, vacation things. Will you please stop stepping on my heels, she'd say. You know as well as anyone just how small this office is. Don't you know, I'd say, how much I'd love to go to a bar and watch a game? Don't you know how much I'd love a whole bunch of buds, a whole bunch of dude buds hollering yo at me when I come through the door? Yo and mofo and beer me and hey bro and all of that? All my best dude buds on bar stools drinking beer watching the game with me? I am going inside to tend to a patient now, she'd say. I'm afraid we will have to continue this conversation another time. I would really like that, Betsy, to cheer and jeer and hoot and root alongside a band of brothers. I would love that. But do you have any idea how much attention you have to pay to a Red Sox game? Even a regular season Red Sox game? I have decided that I'm going to stand here and listen to you until you are quite finished, she'd say, because I feel I have touched a nerve. But just because I choose not to have dude buds, don't think I don't worry about what I'm missing out on. Don't think I'm not haunted knowing that I might be missing out on things that I'd much prefer not to be missing out on. I am haunted, Betsy. You think I alienate myself from society? Of course I alienate myself from society. It's the only way I know of not being constantly reminded of all of the ways I'm alienated from society. That doesn't mean I have anything against other people. Envy them? Of course. Marvel at them? constantly, secretly study them every day. I just don't get any closer to understanding them. And liking something you don't understand, estranged from it without reason, longing to commune with it, who'd ask for it, Betsy? I ask you, who would ask for it? Are you quite finished now, she'd say? This is turning out to be one of the longest ordeals of my life. But do you want to know what I don't understand even more than I don't understand the boating and the tanning? Reading about the boating and the tanning online. I was already at one remove before the internet came along. I needed another remove? Now I have to spend all the time that I'm not doing the thing they're doing, reading about them doing it, streaming all the clips of them doing it, commenting on how lucky they are to be doing all of those things, liking and digging and bookmarking and posting and tweeting all of those things, and feeling more disconnected than ever? Where does this idea of greater connection come from? I've never in my life felt more disconnected. It's like how the rich get richer. The connected get more connected, while the disconnected just get more disconnected. No thanks, man. I can't do it. The world was a sufficient trial, Betsy, before Facebook. I take back my suggestion that you have something against other people, she'd say, and I'll never suggest a website or a Facebook page ever again. I was a dentist, not a website. I was a muddle, not a brand. I was a man, not a profile. They wanted to contain my life with a summary of its purchases and preferences, prescription medications, and predictable behaviors. That was not a man. That was an animal in a cage. She'd say, when was the last time that you attended church? I'd tell her. She'd say, never is not an option. Everyone has been to church at least once. Try being honest. I'd tell her. She'd say, oh, for heaven's sakes, no one worships a little blue leprechaun. First of all, leprechauns are not blue. Second of all, you know as well as anyone that leprechauns did not make heaven and earth. I see no reason to believe in leprechauns and every reason to believe in God. I see God in the sky, and I see God on the street. Can you really sit there and suggest that you do not feel God at work in the world? I'd tell her. She'd say, one cannot feel the work of the Big Bang. Why must you always bring up the Big Bang when we're trying to have a discussion about God? I'd tell her. She'd say, but you can't be good on account of the Big Bang. You can only be good on account of God. Don't you want to be good? I'd tell her. She'd say, metaphysical blackmail, my patootie. I want you to answer me. Do you think you're good? I'd say, yes, I thought I was good. And then she'd say, she'd think about it for a minute, and she'd say, her voice would drop, and she'd put her hand on my arm, and she'd say, but are you well? She'd say, are you well? Thank you. So this is always the slightly awkward moment in the evening where I stare at you and you stare at me until someone's brave enough to turn on the lights. But I'm happy to answer anything and everything.
Do you read your own audio books? You're awfully good at this.
Yeah. I read my second one, and then when this one came around, I was in Antarctica. So I couldn't make the commute.
That leads to my second question. Yeah. What were you doing in Antarctica?
You've stored this one up for a while. I think I was researching a book, but I was also kind of you must know this. I mean, to some extent. I mean, now that you have a bookshop, it might be different. But when you're a writer, you get very lonely, and I really haven't had a job for a long time. And my first book was very much about people and working life and communities and groups and that sort of thing. And so I wondered how rusty I was in the community setting, really, essentially. And I wanted to find out kind of like, so I went to Antarctica. I went to Antarctica because interestingly, the only way you can get there is when you're with a group of people. And you're thrown together with people in very tight quarters, very tight quarters. So it really tests your appetite for a wide swath of humanity. And so that it was like about 22 days, and people from all over the world. And it was on a tall ship, so it was like an old-fashioned sailboat. So we had to sail through the Drake Passage and then sail back through the Drake Passage to get to Antarctica, which was a major pain in the butt. And everyone got seasick, and you're also on, it's a working sailboat, so you're actually learning how to sail and contribute to the functioning of the ship. So you're really kind of thrown into it, and you really do get a sense of what it's like to be with people again.
And will you write about this?
I hope to, yeah. I mean, it's, I'm not very good at like taking the stuff and then turning it immediately into whatever I want it to be. So it's been a year, it was a year ago, and that's way too soon for me. I think it'll be, you know, 3 or 4 years before I even figure out what it is that I want to write about, but hopefully. According to the tax man, I am.
If this Q&A doesn't work out, I'll just come in.
Okay. Yes?
Why did you decide on a dentist as like the cipher for, you know, some of the messages you were trying to get across with like religion and online life and things like that?
Well, he's not a particularly happy man, as you might have gathered. Dentists are kind of amaze me. I mean, in part, when I was like 20, you know, I'm in college and doing college things, and my gums started to bleed. And, you know, when you're in college and you're doing college things, you think, well, this must be an STD. You know, so I'm dying, and I've got to figure out what I'm dying of and how much time I have left. So I went to the dentist because that's where I wanted to start, and I was really scared, truly. And she's like, "Son, do you ever floss?" And I said, "No, that's a major pain in the butt. Why would I do that?" She said, "All you need to do to cure this problem is to floss." So, you know, I started flossing, and by God, it worked. And I realized what a repository of information and wisdom these dentists were, but I, you know, had always sort of treated them with a bit of scorn as kind of at most a monumental afterthought. And so I was deeply grateful, and it just stayed with me. And when I thought about him looking into mouths all the time, I also, on a more, like a less personal note, I realized that he was the guy that was really closest to death because he was seeing rot and decay. And I mean, even if you're in relatively good health, you can come down with a cavity for whatever reason, age or, you know, some couple of nights there where you just let it slide and, you know, whatever. You go to the dentist, you have a cavity. And he's got to see this every day. And people just don't want to see him, in part because he's a reminder, and in part because he's just, like a pain deliverer. So when I wanted someone deeply disgruntled in order to confront what it meant to be a religious person, I thought the dentist would be a wise career. And I also like to write about other professions, and I thought he would have a lot of like interesting tools and things to talk about and learn about. Yeah?
When did you decide to become a writer?
I would say I was 8. Or 9, you know, and I was like writing these really bad ripoffs of Alfred Hitchcock. It wasn't the birds, you know, it was the crabs. Yeah.
I'm curious about your process. You're saying, you know, Antarctica, you don't even know how that might appear and work later. Do you start with an end in mind and continue with this novel, or? I love the ending, and I was kind of surprised by it. But it struck me as like I couldn't see it coming necessarily. But I'm wondering if that sort of emerged in the process, or did you know where you're heading?
Yeah, most of it is like a process of ignorance, really. I mean, truly, it's a piecemeal thing for me. It would be a lot easier if I could plot it all out. I actually did a considerable amount of plotting for this book, and then never followed through. I mean, truly, I mean, my outlines were like documents of complete failure. And after a while, they just got me so down that I just did away with all of it. I can't do it. Like, it's extremely improvisational for me. It's what happens on the page that day, what might suggest itself to me, you know, walking down the street or in the shower, or something strange that I didn't expect. And it just, to me, it's the only way to do it organically and true and interestingly otherwise, you know. And I'll even come in with an idea that I came up with, you know, that the night before or something. And even in the time that passes between the night before and the next day, when that idea is kind of like, I don't know, it's had some moment to solidify and become the thing I'm going to write, I botch it. You know, I think the model for so much writing and why it's so difficult for young writers, there's a model that out here in the world, there's a kind of platonic version of what you're trying to achieve. And the best way to do it is to come up in your head and you know, like study that model, whatever it may be, and then try to capture it. But when you look at the page, and this is why it's writing is so frustrating for so many people, and you compare it to what you see in your head, the discrepancy is extraordinary. And it just, well, I can't do this. I'm done. And I just wanted a different model. I just wanted a, like, what's the model by which I can finish a day's work and think that doesn't actually have any discrepancy, because it wasn't my intention to try to get this platonic notion of what this thing should be down on the page. And so improvisation became kind of like the new model. And as I improvise on the page, if I like it, I keep it. If I don't, I move on. Yeah.
I'm curious about how that whole ancient people, ancient land came about, that part of the book.
It's really, I mean, to be honest with you, it's just stealing the history of the Jews. It's a parody of the Jews. It's not a parody, ha-ha, like, look at the Jews. It's more like, you know, this is an incredibly rich history and mythos and people and theology. And I was so overwhelmed in learning about it and attracted to it that I, you know, invented the Jews' Jew, which is the ancient religion of in the book. Only basically to talk about the Jews in a way that made it a book about Judaism from an outsider's point, because I'm not Jewish. So I wanted to write about things that I thought about as a kind of like ostensible or putative Christian, a Christian kid growing up in a Christian house, and then learning about Judaism and being kind of overwhelmed and thinking, religion is really, I always dismissed religion. As it kind of like once I got to the age where I was like, oh, you know, it's sort of cool to say you don't believe in God. And then that was it for religion, right? If you don't believe in God, that's it. Religion doesn't matter, doesn't enter in, so don't think about it. And then I went to college and I read about Judaism and I met friends of mine who were Jewish. And the entire experience was very illuminating and very moving and very meaningful to me. And so I wanted to write about Judaism as an outsider, but because I just don't do anything simply, I didn't write about Jews. I wrote about alms, and the book was that was really the impetus for the book.
Thank you. I just want to thank you for this book. I read it in a week, and I belly laughed the whole time.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you very much. It's very nice to hear. Yes, sir.
Besides watching Alfred Hitchcock movies, who did you read as a boy?
I kind of jumped right into the big fellas. Like, I started reading, I mean, I didn't understand them, but I did read them. And I read them with great relish because I was very interested in what they were saying. I just didn't know what was going on. So I read Lolita when I was 12. And I remember, you know, confronting that foreword by John Ray Jr. and thinking, oh my God, this is true. You know, this really happened. So it was interesting because Nabokov is always setting little, you know, traps for the reader. And I was just his plaything for years, you know. I was like, have you read this memoir called Lolita? It was a very, you know, naive reading. But I knew that I loved the words. And this is sort of the same for Dostoevsky, you know. Like, those were the two guys that I read. And they just sort of fed an appetite for understanding adult things. You know, I'd put away childish things by that point, and I wanted to understand the adult world, and they were such an overwhelming and just the best ambassadors for that sort of thing, you know, because they got straight to it, and there were murders, and there was sex, and it was cool. I will say that my ninth grade English teacher, I went to her in a suburb of Chicago, and said, "Do you know this book, Lolita?" And by gosh, she had it on her shelf, and she handed it to me. And I just think that's fantastic. No fear. I mean, by that point, you know, it's considered a classic. It was 92. So it's entrenched. It's no big deal. But, you know, who knows? Yeah.
I loved your short story, The Dinner Party. And just wonder how much of your time you're working on short fiction versus longer projects, and also when might we see a collection?
I hope to come out with a collection anytime soon. I mean, I would love to, you know, see some of that money. So hopefully soon. But I don't spend any time writing short fiction, unfortunately. I mean, I have a lot of ideas and I would like to write short fiction, but I just get seduced by the novel and then it's over. I just wake up and sleep and eat the novel. And so I don't know, you know, I don't spend a lot of time, unfortunately. I wish, but maybe another couple of stories, 3-4 stories, if I can get them in, then I'll come up with a collection. Yeah.
I was wondering about the character of Abby, what really does she represent?
He's this is a woman who, I don't know if you haven't read the book, she doesn't speak. She's his dental assistant, so she's always opposite the chair from him, and she has a mask over her mouth. You know, when I think his behavior is so bad that I wanted someone to always be observing it. And in many respects, it's God. I mean, it's how I think a lot of people think about God. You know, you're never really alone in the room. There's God, too. And so there's a moral imperative to behave. And the easy conclusion that you're flawed. Well, in his case, it's absolutely true, but when that authority is bestowed onto another human being, for many people, for atheists as well, I think it becomes the moral guiding principle. And so that's what she is there for, I think. It is to judge him, to make him feel self-conscious, to make him feel unnerved. I mean, she never, by virtue of never speaking, she holds an extraordinary amount of authority. Yeah.
What's your process? Do you get up and work every day? Do you have a routine? And secondly, could you characterize, or would you characterize, or is it possible to characterize what in your heart of hearts you think are the most important themes that you like to address? Do you have something that you...
Well, I work, you know, from like 9 to 5, hopefully, and then a half day on Sunday. And without it, I would be, you know, I'd kind of go crazy. The themes, I don't know how to say it. I don't know how to answer that exactly. I mean, I know that there's a lot of filtering out of things that I find insignificant. I write them because, as I just admitted, I write from 9 to 5. That's a lot of writing, and I don't come out with a book. Somebody said to me, there was a woman, Helen Oyeyemi, who's a young, very young writer she's like 30, and she's like 5 novels or something. And we were at dinner, we did a joint reading, and she goes, do you teach? And I said, no. And she goes, oh, I just wonder what you do with your time. There's so much time between your books. And I said, we can't all be child geniuses, Helen. So I throw away a lot, is my point. And a lot of that, I think what gets thrown away is something that is inessential. You know, I mean, in this book I'm talking about religion and suicide and identity and these kind of things. And sooner or later, those are the things that come to, you know, rise to the top. It's just that's, I don't know. Other things seem frivolous, or they seem even. I find myself even cutting out funny things simply because they're only funny, and that seems, you know, it seems useful in certain respects. It's good for the sitcom, but I think the novel is. It needs to. I think the novel needs to be doing more than that. It needs to be having many different things going on, and I don't think that simply being funny is reason enough to be in it. So, I know the only way to say it is it's the importance. I try to put only the important stuff in there, which makes the books all really heavy and stuff. But you know, whatever. Yeah. Yeah. It's never easier, I don't think. You know, I wish I were more efficient, and I wish that I were better, but I also wish that I, you know, played tennis like Federer, you know, and that I, you know, there are a lot of things I wish. And just because I'm not as efficient as I want to be, I mean, really, I think writing fiction is essentially having to contend with how little you have to offer, because you're given the authority, the license, to do whatever you want. But you're constantly confronted by your own limitations as a writer, as a person, as a man in my case, as a husband, as a father, whatever the case may be, there are my limitations every day. And so I think of my life as a kind of reconciliation with humility, basically. You know, this is how little I have to offer. And just as I do wish to be more efficient, I also wish to be much more powerful on the page. But by virtue of not being, I've had to reconcile myself with that and then play to my strengths and be aware of when I'm doing things right. So it is to want more out of what I do and to want to edit less and to want to write less is simply to want to be a different person. And I'm okay with being me. But, you know, it does pain me. It's not always fun.
Do you have any tricks to reconcile that?
Any tricks? Age. Yeah, age.
Yeah. Besides the book of what other authors do you feel were big influences on?
I would say that the person that I find most meaningful to read and reread now is probably Virginia Woolf. I don't think that anyone is quite as good as she is. But you know, I read a lot of men that like American men who I just can't do what they do, like Pynchon and DeLillo and David Foster Wallace, and guys that, you know, are sort of like, and I mean, this is, you know, the list is long for white American dudes, you know. And I read all of them, but I sometimes I feel like I'm tapping into that vein and sometimes I don't. I mean, some of the writers that were most significant to me, you know, don't really merit too much of attention. I mean, I was a big Charles Portis fan, and I was a big William Maxwell fan, and those are weird, like, you know, like the combination of those two. Like, if you put Charles Portis together with William Maxwell and they had a love child, that's some weird shit. So, I don't know how exactly it works, but that's probably who, you know, they contributed in one way or another. You guys are awesome. Thank you very much for being here. I'm happy to sign books.